After attending services for Shavuot.
For
Shavuot?
Where?
Yeah. Actually, I went to Shai Tzion for the second day in the morning, and to Bet Torah the first day, and the Shabbat before that, it had rained, so I had went to Kol Yisrael.
Yeah. It's on Best Third Avenue, isn't it?
Cimentel.
Kol Yisrael, Cimentel, yeah.
Yeah, Cimentel. Which I, it's my first time there.
Yeah.
That's actually very close to where I live. I live 2 blocks from there.
Oh, really?
So, it's a beautiful synagogue.
Yeah, that's a new one. We just built a beautiful one here. New
is that the one on Dealer Road?
Gorgeous.
Yeah, beautiful. From the outside, it's gorgeous.
It is. It's exquisite.
Is it a long walk from here?
For me, it's about 35 minutes. So I wish it were closer because I would prefer to go there rather than to the Deal Synagogue.
And what's the name of that synagogue?
Magen David. That's the original name of the synagogue as established by my father, Alav HaShalom, here. The first synagogue was Magen David on 67th Street, between Bay Park, between 20th and 21st. Bensonhurst. Yeah. It's right there. It's a beautiful synagogue. It was built, I still remember the parade. I was a baby at the time. I guess about 70 years ago. Uh-huh. 70, 72 years ago. And it's still beautiful. Very, very.
And there's still people there?
Yes. Not too many, but there are some.
Is Haimi Karen, is that where he goes to?
No, no more. He used to. He was there till not too long ago, but he know he lives in our area.
Is there some chazan for?
No, they don't. It's just Baleva thing that becomes a Hezbollah.
So Magen David here just opened recently, didn't it?
Yes, they had, the building is new, but they had bought a very large home on that same land. They bought it. That was a very, very fortunate move that we made there. That used to be the headquarters of this movie magnate who owned movie houses, what's his name? He lived in, that was his central headquarters. It was a very large home, they knocked it down. And they bought that whole land. I think there must be something like 4 or 5 acres of land there.
Wow.
And they used it for about maybe 8, 9 years, 10 years. And they built next to it the youth center, which is another low building you see on the side there, and that's very nice, very good. And about a year ago, they planned this new synagogue. And they had no problems, they got the variance. It's a beautiful synagogue, very, very pretty. Inside is very bright, very airy. But I like the the philosophy of the congregation there. The rabbi is Rabbi Labatin, Rabbi Ezra Labatin. He's a young rabbi.
I heard of him, yeah.
And
he's like a very active.
Very. And I'm very happy he is one of my brother David's proteges in Bet Torah.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
He is one of my brother David's proteges.
Proteges, oh really? Wow.
Wow. In fact, when he got married, David was the one that made the Sheva Berachot for him.
Oh, wow.
He and Rabbi Harari, with the youth, Minyan and Magen David in Shaarei Siyon, both came much under David's influence. And we maintain our traditions by people of our school of thought, particularly my family, but people of our school of thought, we maintain our tradition, we adhere to our traditions. And, you know, really, it's a little the fault of our community in that we didn't have a school of higher education to train rabbis. So necessarily they had to go to Ashkenazi institutions. And there they became accustomed and imbued with their minhagim. And right now we resent it very much. But that's the way it is. Now, Rabbi Labatin went to Yeshiva University, as my brother David did. Mm-hmm. But they adhere to our minhagim, and there's a big conflict in the community now. There's big friction, rather, I should say, in terms of these other rabbis who are trained in, say, Baltimore or
New Israel,
in Plainers and places like that. There's a direct conflict. Some of our menhagim and our philosophy, and we find some of them now with the siyot dangling outside or with long peyot, wearing black hats as if that's part of a uniform, and we resent it. We don't mind it. I mean, in Florida, I have a beautiful minyan where we pray in Olympus. We have a very, very active minyan, Baruch Hashem. We have services in the morning, in the afternoon. We have a class every morning after Tefillah. We have classes on Shabbat for men, for women. Very active. And we have a Lubavitcher, which is maybe half a mile away from us or so. We support them. I allow them to come. They speak in our synagogue, the rabbi. We support them financially. They're building quite a nice complex where they are. We dedicated some mitzvot there in the name of our minyan. I mean, last year they had a banquet. I'm not sure that we took two tables for our Sephardic, we call it the Sephardic, Olympic Sephardic minyan. We support them, but does not necessarily mean that we don't have to, you know, adhere to their minhagim. Like you take Rabbi Hecht, who's a Lubavitcher.
Right.
Also, he says, my Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson, do not let one of their minhagim go by the wayside. It's, every one of them is precious. Their minhagim, you must adhere. That's the congregation. And he does, he adheres to our minhagim.
I sort of sense that for myself, that the younger generation, or the younger rabbis,
they're all educated by the Ashkenazim.
Right.
There's many things, some of them minor, others, but the problem is that they do create a divisive atmosphere. Removing shoes for the Berchat Kohanim, you know, what you call Duchan.
Right, Duchan.
We make Berchat Kohanim every day.
Right.
The year.
Right.
And on Yom Ta'anit we make twice a day.
Right.
And so on. And we don't remove our shoes, nor do we wash our hands. Now, the Ashkenazim, they make a very big ceremony out of it. They do it, what, 2-3 times a year?
Shalosh Regalim,
Yamim and Yamim Noraim. 2-3 times. They make a big deal of it, and they wash their hands, and the Levi wash their hands, and they take their shoes off. And now, some of our youngsters, they go to Israel for 1 or 2 years, which is very nice. In Israel, that's their minhag. Everybody removes their shoes when they make the
even amongst the Sephardim?
Yes. That's their minhagim. Now, when I go there, I don't remove it.
Yeah.
And I go and I pray with Hacham Abadiah Yosef in his synagogue. I don't remove my shoes. Last year I spent Shavuot in Israel, and I prayed in Tel Aviv. And the Sephardim, many of them are Lepians, but it's mixed. They're in Israel, you know, you get a mixture. I felt obliged to remove my shoes because everybody removed their shoes. All the Kohanim, they all went up to Duchan. I didn't go and wash my hands. So they know I'm Kohen and so on and so forth. They invited me to pray at times and so on. Yeah, aren't you going to wash your hands? I said, no, we don't have that in hand. So I'm going to let you have a book. Because, I mean, we ish our smell is mochet. We don't do it just. The only time we wash our hands is on Kippur and Neila. And there's a reason for it. Why? Because we're not allowed to make Netilat Adam on Yom Kippur. We just wash the tips of our fingers. So, the Shat Neila, when Kippur is practically over, now makes ceremony. And what do? We have to stop services for 20-25 minutes. Maybe our forefathers also did it for expediency's sake, or because it was practical. And I consulted with Rabbi Yadid, who was the head rabbi in Halab, and is here now. And I have a study class with him every morning. That's when I just came from. And although Maran says, you remove your shoes, you wash your hands, he says, but our minhag is before Maran. He says, in Halab, nobody removes shoes. There was only one man that removed their shoes. His shoes. But he removed their shoes. That's our minhag. And maybe it's for expediency's sake. Now, you've been in Shaar HaZion. What do you think if every Kohen removed their shoes and went out to wash their hands?
Yeah, it would take 25 minutes.
It would create bedlam, Talul Hashem.
Yeah.
So we used to, and it was bedlam on Kippur, and then we passed a new regulation. Stop the Tefillah. We stop the Hazan. Stop. Let them go. It takes 20, 25, 30 minutes for them to go out and wash. We don't remove our shoes, just to wash their hands. And they go, and the Kohen puts some mazahar, you know, some rose water on their hands. And maybe for expediency's sake. Oh, no, you come here on Shabbat in this synagogue, in any synagogue. We have a lot, maybe because we have a lot of Kohanim, they did away with it. But in any case, the I don't know if you know the background of that, you want to call it Minhag, I don't think it's a din. Do you?
No, I don't. No, I'm not a Kohen, so I've never...
Well, during Bayit Sheni, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai established that custom.
Uh-huh.
During Bayit Sheni. And that was because the streets were very, very muddy, and they were filled with the excrement and the dirt and so on and so forth. And he established then a rule that whoever went up to the Khan, the Kohanim that went up to the Khan only, and since the kind of garments that they wore were these robe garments like, when they raised their hands, the ones on the Khan, they are more or less on eye level with the Kahal that was standing on the ground. And when they saw their shoes filled with filth and excrement and so on, for Kavod HaBriyot, it has nothing to do with Kedusha.
Mm-hmm.
For Kavod HaBriyot, so that they should not be disgusted with the view at eye level of these filthy shoes, they passed an edict that the ones that went up to the Khan only removed their shoes. The ones standing on the ground on the did not move their shoes. And Maran did it, put it in his Shulchan Aruch. And I'm washing it tonight, today, we don't have them in the head. If my hands are Meluchlachim, if they're dirty, how do I put the tefillin on?
Mm-hmm.
How do I stand and pray?
Right.
If they are. All I've done is that, stood and prayed. I put the tefillin to the lid, and I stood and I prayed. Why should my hands be needed to wash? Now, obviously, they stopped to wash if they had to remove their shoes with their hands, maybe.
Right.
For that reason. We don't. So, I personally resent it very much.
Mm-hmm.
Like my cousins. I'm sorry to say, they're not knowledgeable anyways. It's a wheel, though.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, last year, I say, he moves his shoes, my cousin Harry. I said, what are you doing? I'm doing my shoes. I'm like, that's halakha. He doesn't even know how to read. Didn't your father and Hashem know halakha? Didn't Chacham Chaim tell you? I'm talking now, mentioning the rabbis and the knowledge of here in the community. Didn't Chacham Chaim tell you know halakha? Chacham Dweik did not know halakha? Chacham Maslaton did not know. I'm talking old Kohanim. My father and Hashem know halakha. Your father did not know halakha. And I mentioned 8:10. He says, you want to be ashamed of yourself. It's an insult to your father's memory. So he's talking about his brother is more. Got him on every, so he gets and he goes up to the Hechar. It happened. I mean, one other person also was totally non-knowledgeable at all, don't know how to read. Well, it's not something. Why are you taking your shoes off? Well, they do it when I pray and his brother Wadi sits in Oil Yaakov. I think Oil Yaakov, they call it Beit Yaakov, I forgot. I don't know, maybe all, he said they all remove their shoes. I don't know, maybe they establish that night. We don't. No, somebody is taking it. So first he went up to the first step. Then he gets a little more gutsy to go up to the second. Now that creates a division. So I went up to the Dukhan with my shoes. As it happens in Shaare Siyon, I always go up there because we don't fit on the level ground.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a few of us go up on top, and I've always had been like, I go right up. So I get up there. I said, hey, have your shoes on? I said, huh, you see? Now all of a sudden it's become a deen. So halakha, I can't get up there with my shoes. How come you go up there when you take the Sefer Torah down? I don't understand. It has nothing to do with Kedushah. It has nothing but only for Kavod HaBriyot. So now the things, and but the crucial point there is that now it creates a difference. I resent it very much. It's such a small thing, and I always talk about it anyways.
Yeah. Hmm. It's interesting. When I went for Shavuot and I talked with many people with. You know Rabbi Ralph Tal? He's a young man.
Yeah, he's a Beit Torah also. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I thought he would be. I also talking with your, I guess, nephew, Isaac Addis.
Isaac Addis, that's my nephew, yeah.
And they were telling me that the social hall that's very close to Beit Torah is up for sale.
That used to be a club.
Right, a social club, right. And they said that the more, I guess, right-wing, religious, whatever part of the community wanted to take it, and so did people from Beit Torah, and they said it was just a real bitter battle, and Isaac Addis was very, very disturbed by it, really telling me how much it really hurt him, sort of in the same way that you were describing, just in terms of the divisiveness and the friction in the community.
Yeah. See, this rabbi that wanted to take, this is the Yeshivat Mekdash Melech, Ateret. Ateret. Rabbi Yosef Raful. And see, but when he established his yeshiva and congregation. See, I, as a matter of fact, maybe 20 years ago, I had him in my house, and we were inviting him to become the principal. He used to teach in the Flatbush yeshiva in the high school. He and his brother, Abraham Rafur, who's in that other synagogue.
Yeah,
that's why his brother, I mean, is off the wall altogether. I mean, he's...
Where's he? Is he from...
Halab. From, originally, their parentage is from Halab, but they came from Israel. They were born in
Israel. Isn't it like a French accent? Or
no, Israeli. Israeli. Maybe they spoke French there. Yeah. He's off the wall altogether. I mean, he's not completely stable anyways. His brother, who's younger, is very knowledgeable. He's good, though. It's very transparent, Hacham, and very, very extremist. And so he used to teach in the Flatbush Yeshiva in the high school. Then at one time, I was chairman of the educational committee in Magen David. We were in the process of changing principles, and it occurred to us that here's a man educated Halabi, or from our tradition, even if he's not maybe up to everything as far as the educational system and modern system, but, you know, he's got something. And I invited him in my house on a cup of tea. No, he wouldn't come unless, so because we were co-ed. But Rabbi, you're teaching in a co-ed school anyway. This is our community. No, and I spoke to him very roughly. I said, you know, you people, you come here, you reap the benefits, every benefit that this community has to offer, and you don't feel responsibility that you have to contribute. I spoke to him rough because he just turned it down. He wouldn't. But that's his conviction. He wouldn't. Eventually, an answer to the fact that he was teaching, and he says, that's not my school. But found, this is my community. My school, I will not promote that. Okay, so then he went and established his own yeshiva, which is separated.
Mm-hmm.
Not good. But he went by himself out of the community and established his own self. He didn't come. See, for example, we resent Rabbi Dweck, but he's doing very much on this. There's a royal battle ongoing here all the time.
He's a rabbi of which synagogue? The Deal
Synagogue? Yeah, the Deal Synagogue. Yeah. And he's a man that also we subsidized his education in Baltimore. He came from Halab. Too long ago. I mean, I guess he must be 45 or so, and he's been here maybe 30, 35 years. He came as a young boy, 12 years old. And he also taught in Magen David Yeshiva for a while. He was a good teacher, strong teacher. And then when they wanted a young rabbi, I said, who better? This here, he's a Sephardi from Halab, background, let's bring him over here. Little did we know that he was totally imbued with the Ashkenazic philosophy, and he's married to Ashkenazim, a very religious family, observant family, obviously, and that creates a tremendous influence over him. And I mean, for example, he has got a son, Solomon Shlomo, he calls him. Now that's not us.
Yeah.
And a couple of times we are marked, he lets a little seed dangle, Rabbi, or seed showing, and so he started. Now lately he started putting on a black hat, and it's created such a commotion in our synagogue, such a commotion in the whole community. Why? And I thought, why? Well, also, why are you wearing a black hat? He and his sons, now he's got two sons, Bar Mitzvah, that wear black hats, and they said no. And that's rubbing everybody the wrong way, and it encourages. And he's setting up kollel. Another kollel, notwithstanding, we have a very nice kollel here.
And he's establishing another kollel?
Yeah, he established it.
Who's organizing first? Who has the first kollel?
Rabbi Diamond. He is Ashkenazi, but his mother is Sephardi, one of that, and he adheres to Armin Hagim, very, very nice young rabbi. And it's a very nice and successful kollel.
That's a kollel here in Deal.
Yeah. All of a sudden, this man was there, and he built a building next to the synagogue. At first, he bought the land, we didn't want to buy it against the consensus of the committee of the very, he got other private people. Now, he does very many things unilaterally with that, and that's nice. And there were no students, so he brought 12, 14 students from Lakewood. So there's three, maybe I think three. Are there? Maybe there's three Sephardim, and all the other brought this Ashkenazim from Lakewood and put them in the kollel. Can you imagine how they, what kind of antagonism that creates? Not because they're Ashkenazim. Why are you opening another kollel in competition with the other man?
Wait, the new kollel has the boys from Lakewood? Oh, the new one. Okay. Not the one from Rabbi Diamond.
No.
Okay.
My Diamond, I think they're all.
They're all Sephardim?
Sephardim.
Uh-huh.
So this was, now you stop to think, what motivates a man like that to do this?
Right. Do you find that the younger generation is in more of support of the more religious than the older generation?
It depends. You see, now the problem is that the ones that you see that support more, they're the ones that are more vocal, and they're the ones that you see.
Right.
because obviously you go to synagogue, they are there. Right. Some of the others, maybe they're not there.
Right.
But the majority is not that way.
Right.
We are more religiously inclined, I think this is generally in the United States, because of yeshivot.
Right.
I mean, this is very, that's a very simple right. thing to understand. I mean, you take my son, I go, I've told you the sequence of events that happened, how my son was the first born in the Sephardic community that went to yeshiva. And he went to Flatbush yeshiva.
No, you didn't tell me that.
Well, I was always concerned. You see, our home has always been an observant home, a religious home. My father, Hamasham, was a businessman all the time, but he had a library which was mind-boggling. And, I mean, he passed away. I was 17 years old, so I was very conscious of his mode of life.
Were you the oldest?
No, I'm next to the youngest.
Oh, it's David?
David is the youngest.
Yeah, is.
Harry is older than I am, and the others have gone on, have passed away. I'm next to the youngest. And he learned Torah, on the average, probably during the course of a 24-hour day, I would say 6 to 8 hours. And that was just a way of life. And outstanding that, he was a very elegant man, very elegant dresser, had a beautiful Van Dyke. He loved music, had a beautiful voice, as we trace it to his side. And he was very knowledgeable in music. He was very sophisticated. He loved luxury. He loved a good time. He would be the first to go to a resort. He would be the first to go to a show. By show, I mean, well, if there was a circus or something like that, he doesn't object to it. In other words, he always told us, Torah is made for you to live by and to enjoy it. I don't recall him ever reprimanding us or telling us, this is what you must do. He always told us, Torah is beautiful. In order for you to enjoy it, you have to understand it. If you understand it, you love it. And that was it.
That's wonderful.
And so you say, how did he put so much time? He was a businessman. Well, these people, they all get up early, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, they have to get up and make a little Turkish coffee. He sit and studies. Always, books were always next to him. Whenever I remember, whenever I think of my father, he has an open book with a pair of glasses on it, here, there, and everywhere. This is the way I visualize it. Time for tefillah in the morning, he went to synagogue, and he went. They always had shiur before he came back home. He'd have breakfast and go to business. They don't eat out. Like us,
mm-hmm.
Okay, 3:30, 4 o'clock, he's back home. You have a little something, a little bite, and you have a study group home. That was a very choice study group, 4, 5, 6 people. It was Mekubel as well. He was very instrumental in convincing Rabbi Jacob Kasten to stay here. He was a shaliah. He came 1 year, and next year I made him, because at the time Rabbi Kasten was also Mekubel. He studied Kabbalah with him. He wanted to.
How often do you study Kabbalah? Is that part of his regular?
Part of his regular studies. He studies everything. And then he has supper. He has supper afterwards. Sure, he listened to music. They loved to listen to it. He had a terrific sense of humor. He was always joking. When he walked into the synagogue, the young and the old, they all had a laugh on him. He had to find a nice thing to say or a joke to crack or something. And he was very, very much against people who just found ways to make Isur. I'll never forget the day. They always used to call him Chacham Abraham anyways, but he wasn't a rabbi.
His name was Abraham Torah?
Abraham. He was a very, very nice, very religious man. Shamma, his name was David Shamma. Very, very. And tuna fish? No, you can't eat tuna fish. People that travel tuna fish, that's all they eat. What can they eat? They either eat bananas or tuna fish. There's nothing else they can eat. Is it true? Tuna fish is not kosher? He said, who said? Acham David Shamma. Of course, even David Shamma was younger than him. Acham David? Why are you saying tuna fish is not kosher? Well, yeah, we don't know. You don't know. First, you have to find out. But these people, this is all they have to eat when they're in the city, when they're down uptown, when they have this. You're going to forbid it for them. If this tuna fish is not kosher, they'll eat something else that's not kosher as well. And you can't. And he said, Yafei kowa hamatir. You'll find some way to make it easy for them. Anyways, we live by this. This is always our philosophy. Maybe at times we transgress. God forgive us. You know, but we transgress not. We don't say, okay, this is against halakha, or that's the way halakha, you should do it. No, we didn't control ourselves. But the other day, this Shabbat, precisely Shabbat, I'm sitting and I see there's a pamphlet in front of me, how to have a kiddush in your home. Rabbanu Shel Olam, it was a printed one. If one has to go through that, have to make a kiddush, you'd stop making a kiddush in your house. It means a celebration. To tape the closets, there was so much, these are extremities which are, it's not us. It's not us.
Why would you? I've heard extreme things. I've never heard of taping the closets.
So that when you get the people that do the help, they shouldn't take a plate that could not have been for dairy or for meat. Okay. No, for meat or for dairy. They shouldn't make a mistake. Okay. You have no idea. The lights before in advance. And well, of course, they do. And nobody puts lights on and so on. But so many sayagim, and the sayagim, and the sayagim. It was 6 pages, each page the size. What is this?
Do you attribute all this? What do you attribute it to?
I attribute it to extremism, and I attribute it to lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's why I attribute it to it. Now, and the proof of that is that most of his very strong supporters are ones who are new converted to observance.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know much. And their most vulnerable ones are the ones that have had a tragedy in the home. That's when they're most vulnerable. Okay, which is good. You bring them to a religion. I'm not against that.
Right.
See, the trouble is you can't talk against... When you hide behind the banner of religion, you have a person like me at a disadvantage. Oh, you're against religion? I'm not against religion. Right. So I'm with that. You want to stop this? No, I'm not on that. So all of a sudden it becomes, are you for or against religion? Right. Observance or not observance. So you can't, we were thinking of having a general meeting this Shabbat for... A lot of things happened wrong here in the last few months. And some of my colleagues and friends, and he says, we're at a disadvantage. And you're against studying of Torah? Because we resent very much the fact that this Kollel is open next to the synagogue. First of all, it's created on a monastery among the Goyim here. They came and they threw bricks at the windows, and they threw them adults, adults, men. And it creates much ill feeling towards us. And it's not needed.
Mm-hmm.
Not only it's not needed, he hurt Rabbi Diamond's feelings very much. Who was supposed to be his buddy. Rabbi, when he goes away, this rabbi doesn't allow anybody else to, only Rabbi Diamond, because he knows he can't usurp any of his... He's busy in this college. We have Rabbi Nahum, probably more knowledgeable than both of them. Rabbi Diamond as well as Rabbi. I'm not just exaggerating. He's a man that studies Torah 10 hours a day. Very knowledgeable. He's a Hazan. But he's very, very tremendous Talmid Hacham. More as value to us, is more as a Talmid Hacham than as a Hassan, anyways. Wouldn't allow him to speak. He's afraid that he should. And the Ranahum is a Halabi, and he's of our liberal leaning inclinations. He doesn't want anybody to undercut
this. How do you spell
his name? Edmond Nahum. But, I don't know, this covers a lot of it, but
It's so interesting because many, of course, as many of the same issues in the Ashkenazi community.
This is what we have always been very fortunate. I'm not going to say proud, but we've been fortunate that we have not been tainted with that.
Yeah.
Until Daniel, you didn't know my brother Isaac. He, in his last years, he lived here all year round for maybe 5-6 years. And all my brothers were always mine. He was president of Shahar Esyon at one time. Every time he'd want to make a president, he wouldn't take it. Been accepted. 12 years. He says, "Well, you watch what's going to be in this community 10, 12 years down the road with this rabbi." Sure enough, that's what's happening. And we were never that. Our community was always just one unit. And now there's so much division between children and parents, between cousins, between friends. Brothers, one is this way, the other is not. We never had that. It is in the Ashkenazi, unfortunately. It exists in the Ashkenazi, but we never had it.
Do you think it's partly due to Ashkenazi influence in terms of people going to...
Yes. Who's up here? The 17th, there's a concert of Hazanim from all over the world. And Sion is going, Yaskel Sion, as well as Nahari.
Wow.
They're going to attend. Nahari attended last year also. And just yesterday they called me to go to represent the community and to give them a resume of the background of our... But I just put in a call, he's not in. I can't go. I got out of the engagement of my grandson just a few days after that. It means if I go, I'd have to go to Israel and come back in 4 days. It's just a big hassle to ride on that airplane for 40 hours back and forth, 30 hours or so.
That's too bad you can't go.
Yeah, so I would have liked to be there. And I, you know, we could, I could add a lot to, but it's just too much.
Do you find that these issues in terms of, it's, as you said, it's hard to say that it's an issue between religious and not religious, because the people, like, as you're claiming, you're not claiming not to be religious, but I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, you have, sort of have...
The extremists are not
extremists, okay.
Mahmirim.
The Mahmir, the ones who are Mahmir.
But you see, the main thing is, besides Mahmirim, that they're not Aram and Hagim. Now, you know, I mean, you're familiar with Shulchan Aruch. Now, you, we have, you know, you have Maran and you have Murah. We don't have them. The other was appendix, then added by the Ashkenazi.
The Ramah.
What's his name? It's not Luria.
No,
that was referred to as the Ramah. Ramah. The Ramah. Yeah. I mean, it was a beautiful, beautiful Shulchan Aruch, exactly what Maran did. And then this was added because of the Minhagim of the Ashkenazim. Fine. But we do not adhere to them.
Right.
So, this is the conflict that's creating. That's why I tell you that when they hide behind the banner of religiosity, and then now they tell you, so they want to put you in that kind of a light. Like all this time when I'm opposing you, they tell you, oh, Lashon Hara, of course, is wrong. I'm not against Motal. It becomes that. Even if I say so myself, some of the extremists in the Ashkenazim, they'll stop at nothing. Nothing. The end justifies the means. There's no question about it. They'll hit, they'll kill, they'll nothing. They won't stop at anything. They'll talk Lashon Hara. They're just extremists. They get carried away. I mean, you don't have to go far. You go to in Israel, in Yerushalayim, the Tre Karta. All you have to do is look at that section and get it.
That's fortunately a very small group.
Yes.
But you're right. You're absolutely 100%.
But that's the extremism. Yes. That's what carries them there. And yet, there's a very beautiful book. It's out of print. Depicting the background of Sephardim throughout the whole world. I don't even have a copy here. I had one and I lost it. It's by Elazar. As a matter of fact, I gave a discourse on it and referred to some of the passages in that book. In Florida when I was, and maybe 40 guys said, I want that book. And I asked the center to get it. My daughter Sheila, as it happened, gave me that book. She didn't give it to me. I was in her house and I picked it up. One of these days when you were there, yeah. It has pretty large library.
What's
there.
The title of the book? Is it in Hebrew? Or
the Other Jews. No, in English.
The Other Jews.
The Other Jews.
Okay.
And the research behind it is terrific, because he gives you the background of practically every Sephardi congregation in the United States. And he's accurate, because when I read ours, to the T, what is that? And then he brings in Israel what's happening to the Sephardim over there, and what happened, the evolution of the Sephardim, the importance of the Sephardim there as it takes place, and so on and so forth. And it's a brilliantly written book, and very, very true and authentic. I still can't get it. It's called The Other Jews by Elazar. What's his first name? I forgot his first name. Elazar. Rabbi, I was mentioning it, and Rabbi Fa'ur says, oh yeah, Elazar, you said, yes, I read that. Rabbi Dweck heard that I made a discourse and also quoted that book, and he's trying to, he couldn't get it. The other day he was asking, I says, Rabbi, I wanted 50 books for my friends over there, and I couldn't get them.
They don't publish it anymore?
Maybe they're going to publish it again. Oh, so far now it's out of print. Very, very informative book.
I've just been involved with getting books that are out of print. There are places that will search for books.
See if you could find that, Eliza.
Okay,
I could use 50 of them.
Okay, 50. Okay. Yeah. I'll let you know.
And it'll go through the center. The center one, that's they're trying very hard.
Yeah, I'll let you know when I come up with. I mean, so the ones who are more extreme, do you find, are they still adhering to, you know, in terms of the, in tefillah, are they still adhering to the makamat and still adhering to all
that? Yes, that's established. That's as far as the the whole mode of the tefillah is the same. Mm-hmm. It does not
there's no
change.
There's, they haven't made any changes to the tefillah?
No, not at all. Hmm. And really, I appreciate what Sam Katten and his friends, although the last book also, David wasn't wrong, the New Siddur, that one. Yeah. He's found into introduction there. It's to be really appreciated that they're taking it, because it takes a lot of time and effort to do these. Mm-hmm. And because it makes it easier for the less knowledgeable individuals to follow the tefillah when it's being said, led by Yahsubur, or at home when they're praying. I mean, like, you take this book, this is fabulous.
Yeah,
this is a court book. Yeah. It's fabulous. I mean, it's so simple. You don't, you know, for the not knowledgeable individuals, makes it so simple. You just open it, that's all, 1, 2, 3, you go, and and even for the ones that are knowledgeable, it makes it much easier, much simpler. You don't have to depend on your memory, and was it there? Yeah, oh yeah, it's there.
Right.
It's very, very informative, very good. Mm. Very well done.
One thing that I liked about it is that the different parts of the service that are sung, like during Shacharit, are all like separated out. Like, for example, when Shabbat Anim,
yes,
is said, I mean, it's already separated up. You know, it's going to happen.
Yes.
Also, Kel HaHadaot.
Yes.
And Yimitzram Gel Tam. I mean, all throughout, it's really kind of, and Smechim V'Tzeitam. I mean, they have little dots, so you know that.
That's so you know that that's a little separated from
that. I mean, that was really, that helped me in sort of learning.
Yes.
Going on. So, it's great. In some ways, this is easier to follow than the Siddur.
Of course, because it's so orderly.
Yeah.
That you don't have to turn from one path to another.
Thinking of making.
You're just going
on.
Well, this Siddur was just done, and I criticized it some. And that there are some things that were left out. But it's not done as elaborately as this.
Right.
See, in these, like these separations that you just mentioned and so on, it's not done as elaborately as that.
But still, this is very good.
Yeah.
There's also another one that I saw that was done by someplace called the Alepian Society. I think it was much. A little bit earlier, and I think
there's a few.
I think it was called Beit Yosef.
Beit Yosef.
Was the name in the Siddur?
Yes, Beit Yosef. That's but you see that many of that Beit Yosef, it was it's printed in Israel, first of all. It's done in Israel, and there are many, not many. There are some things, even though it's our minhagim, our system, but there are some which are taken from there. For example, in the Tehanunim, on Yom Shani and Hamishi, on weekdays I'm talking. Ve'yabor, we say Ve'yabor four times. This is after the
Tefillah. This is something I'm not familiar with. This is right after the Amidah?
Yeah, after the Amidah, after the Hazara.
Right.
After the Hazara.
What do you call this? We call this Tahanun.
Tahanunim.
Okay.
Yes, Tahanunim.
Right.
Now we say four times by Ya'abur.
Okay.
We, in our minhag, in Aram Sobah, here's the Tahanunim for Yom Shani B'Hamashi. Here's another by Ya'abur, and then they say, An She'e Vadu, Qayl Melech, another by Ya'abur.
Okay.
Qayl Melech, Talan Ya'abur. We say this only on Monday, and we do not say this kina on Monday. On the other hand, on Thursday we say this one, we do not say this one.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the other way, Amor? So at the end of the Tahanunim, this book has just inserted the way Amor, because we're supposed to say it four times.
Right.
The other Israeli, I have that other book. Yeah. So now the other sibling does not have it.
Uh-huh. Does not have the four statements of the Vayivor?
Does not have it there because it's not needed, because they say the two pieces of the Haronim.
Uh-huh.
The portions of the Haronim, they say them both. Even this. This one, which is a very fine siddur. It's a wonderful siddur because it has many
perushim.
Halachot, perushim, and explanations.
Is this the halab siddur or is this the Eidat Mizra?
No, this is done over there in Yerushalayim. But it's supposed to adhere to Aaron Hagim.
What's the name of this siddur?
This is siddur imrefi, but in perush higyon libi. This is a very fine book.
Mm-hmm.
In Perush, Higyon Lebi. See, again, they don't have a Yabur here.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because their minhag is to say both of the portions on every day, both on Monday and Thursday, whereas we don't.
Right. So the halab custom is not to say it.
Not to say the two parts,
the two parts.
But we do say Vayavor at the end here, before we say the Kaddish.
So this is just Eidat Mizrach?
Yes, Eidat Mizrach.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Except that they have a minhag over there that they say them both. Maybe for Torah Sibur we don't say it. I mean, maybe originally it was established that you don't say both keynote, both of this, the Hanunim, parsh of the Hanunim, because of just Torah Sibur, so it shouldn't take that long, the prayer shouldn't take that long. That's the only explanation I can find for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, we'll say this one on Monday, this one we'll say on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
But the Vayabor, you cannot skip. You need to say four times Vayabor.
Any other differences between that Siddur
and which, on this one?
Yeah.
No, there aren't. There are some some of the corrections that I want to make are for the benefit of Hazanim, but not knowledgeable. For example, I want them to insert, you see, there are many, let's say when they come to the Parashiyot,
mm-hmm.
for the weekdays,
mm-hmm.
or Perashiot for a particular special reading, be it one of the Arba'a Somot or Tish'a Be'ab. You see, they have the Perasha, they don't tell you where it's from.
Mm-hmm.
Now somebody that doesn't know, how is he going to find it? Or how are you going to remember?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in order for me to remember Perashat of let's say, Tish'a Be'ab,
mm-hmm.
where is it? What Perasha is it in?
Yeah,
it's very simple to just put Ba'at Hanan.
Yeah.
Put in Perashat Va'et Hanan.
Uh-huh.
Not only that, I also maintain that they should put also the Sefer.
Mm-hmm.
Devarim Va'et Hanan.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have to go ahead and fish and find out where is this part. Where is
right.
Ki Tolid Banim? You know, the Perashat of the other,
right.
Ki Tolid Banim?
Right.
Where are you going to find it?
Yeah.
So these are some of the corrections. On Purim, if Purim is on Mosai Shabbat, how are you supposed to go about it? What do you do? Do you make the Havdalah before you read the Megillah? Or don't you?
Good question.
And
I think you say it after, don't you?
After. But you do make Berchat Me'orei Ha'esh. And the reason should be very simple for anybody to figure out. You need lights. You're going to read the Megillah, you're going to read that. So you make Amos Ha'esh, but you make Berchat Me'orei Ha'esh. You light all the lights that you want. Now you can light lights and finish, all right? You make Ha'esh. And then they have the lights made afterwards.
Right.
Afterwards. And this, I just remember, so they had to, I was in Florida, so the next day, no, they do that. I said, this is where they called New York, and I said, how did you figure it? I seem to remember, and then besides, it's logical. So I say these things, don't leave them for guesswork. Well, don't leave any open questions. Put this information. There is, I have a custom in my house, we read a portion of Zohar on Friday night during the Kiddush, and on Saturday before the Kiddush. Zohar, I don't know if you people have that.
Yeah.
On Friday night, we have the Chotim, Shabbat, the 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 Shabbat, and so on. So Zohar, they didn't have it in the first edition of this, first editions. And I said, why don't you put this? He said, I don't say it. I said, well, we say it. Maybe in your family, you say it. It should have it.
This is on Friday night and Saturday morning.
Yeah, so they put Friday night, they didn't put Saturday morning. I said, because the and we want the Shabbat, the Shabbat, the Shabbat, the Shabbat, the I said, well, you're saving one half a page.
Then
they're doing it, you know, to save so many pages, to make the... Yep,